Hello again, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Hugo Gibson. So the next couple of podcasts that I'm going to be doing are going to be covering different fishing techniques. This week's one is going to cover nymphing and some entomology. And the next one I'm going to do is going to be on fly fishing still waters, something that more and more of us are venturing into. What I've done is I've opened up the threads on FlyAnglersOnline.com for you to ask questions that I can ask directly to the people I'm interviewing. This week it's Rick Hafley. Next week it's going to be Brian Chan. So please grab a notebook and a pencil or a pen and get ready to take some notes. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have with us today Rick Hafley. He is an entomologist and a trout fisherman, and today he's going to share some of his wisdom with us. How are you doing this morning? Or afternoon, I guess it is, Rick.
Yeah, I'm doing great.
Good, good. So give us a little background on what got you into the whole entomology side of fly fishing.
Absolutely. Well, I started fly fishing a long time ago now. I grew up in the Midwest in Illinois. About the time I was 12, I had an uncle in Missouri who was a fly fisherman, and he was kind of the first guy to put a fly rod in my hand down in Missouri and got me into catching fish. And at the same time as a 12-year-old or that age, you kind of like looking at anything that's running around outside. And I had a little bit of an interest in insects, collecting stuff that just flying around the house. But I had an experience, actually, when I was probably about 14 that was pretty impressive on a little farm pond. And at the time, I didn't know much of anything about insects, but there was a big hexagenia hatch on this little farm pond. And one evening, I was out there, and this whole huge hatch of hexagenia came off almost at once. And it was like the whole surface of the lake was just lifting off the water, and it was just absolutely amazing.
Wow.
And that just really left a big impression on me. And then I was already into doing some fly fishing then, so that really got me hooked on trying to figure out some more about bugs just as a kid with no formal training or anything. And then I wanted to get towards some sort of coastal area for college, so I ended up going to college in Bellingham, Washington, at Western Washington University up there, and was interested in fisheries biology. But I took an entomology class as an undergraduate. And then my senior year, the fellow that was the entomologist at the university offered an aquatic entomology class, and I was the only one who signed up for it. And so he went ahead and taught it, and the professor and I would get together and talk about aquatic entomology and all kinds of interesting stuff, and he was the one who really kind of spurred me to go on to graduate school and study aquatic insects more formally. And that whole time I'd been fly fishing, too, and keeping my eye on bugs when I was out fly fishing. So I had a strong connection with the bugs through the fishing end of it, and then just got more formal training as a student, and then went on to grad school at Oregon State University and actually got my degree in aquatic entomology.
Okay.
In Oregon State, and finished that in 1979. That really kind of put it all together for me as far as the aquatic entomology goes.
Excellent.
And it's been great. Just so many interesting insects out there, so it's been a lot of fun.
Good deal, good deal. Now, for those who don't know, what is entomology, and what exactly does an entomologist do?
Yeah, well, real basically, entomology is the study of insects. That's it in a nutshell. And what entomologists do is kind of all over the board, depending on what you specialize in. It's kind of one of those topics that, as you get into it, you realize you got to specialize, because there's just way, way too much things going on with different aspects of insects and entomology to look at it in a general sense. So you have the whole pest management thing, folks that come around your house trying to deal with your termites or carpenter ants and that sort of thing. And then you have a lot of folks get involved in agricultural work related to entomology because of the pest control and all of the interest in trying to use less pesticides and more biocontrol. So that's another arena. Forest entomology is another big area of study.
Right.
But, of course, I specialize in aquatic entomology. And when I started graduate school, I didn't even really ask the question, geez, can you get a job if you're an aquatic entomologist? I had no idea if you could or not. But actually, there is some pretty decent jobs out there. And the area that I really spent my career working in was related to water quality. So there's a lot of interest and use of aquatic insects as indicators of water quality.
Okay.
And that's been going on for some time. and it's gotten more sophisticated and more involved over the years. And now a lot of water quality agencies, state agencies, and the federal EPA have actual protocol and rules and regulations about how aquatic insects and other aquatic organisms, not just insects, are used to evaluate water quality and protect streams and lakes and wetlands. So that's really what I spent my career doing. I worked for the State Department of Environmental Quality in Oregon for 22 years, and before I started working for them, I worked for some consulting firms and did a lot of work up in Alaska and Colorado and California, and then most of my career working in Oregon. So it got me out on streams and some really neat places, and it's been a lot of fun as a career as well as the fishing end of it.
Very, very good. Well, what I did was I opened up a thread to members and non-members alike to ask questions of you in regards to entomology, whatever they had on their minds they could do. And I went ahead, I gave you a copy of that.
Yes. Okay. Excellent questions.
So what we'll do, I think we'll just go down the line and get as many of them answered as we can in about 20 minutes or so. How does that sound? All right, well, the first one I've got here is from a guy whose handle is Sage Fisher, and he says, I sat in on one of Rick's classes in Albany, Oregon at the Fly Tires Expo. He knows his stuff and puts on a great stream fishing class. The question he has for you, he says, does he prefer to use a weighted nymph or use split shot on the leader a couple of feet above the fly when fishing a deep 8 to 10 foot nymphing rig?
Okay, well, that's a good question, and I'm going to start by saying I think the most important thing, and you're fishing nymphs in fairly deep water, is to have enough weight to get them to the bottom. That's going to be the most critical thing.
Okay.
There is some difference of opinion or different approaches whether you weight the nymph or put it on your leader. There is the idea that if you put it on your leader and the nymph isn't weighted, the nymph has more movement to it and looks a little bit more lively in the current. Might look a little more lifelike, and I think that's probably some, definitely validity to that. So might want to put the less weighted nymphs and put enough split shot on your leader to get it down.
Okay.
But I find, especially in the western streams where I fish mostly, where you've got fairly fast streams and some pretty good deep water, you really need both. You're going to need a weighted nymph, and you're going to need a split shot on your leader to get it down. Even when I'm fishing two nymphs, and both the nymphs are weighted, I use split shot on the leader 90% of the time, just because you want to get your flies, your nymphs, as close to the bottom as possible.
Now, this is just my question real quick. Do you usually use a long line nymphing method, or do you use a short line kind of a sight fishing method?
Well, I prefer short line nymphing method because you're going to have a whole lot more control and ability to feel strikes and set the hook.
Right.
Quickly. So a short line nymphing is, I think, much more effective. But again, it depends on the kind of stream you're fishing. I fish fairly big rivers, and you can't wade close enough to a lot of the places you fish, so then you end up using some of the longer line approaches. But but I like to fish as short a line as possible when I'm nymphing.
Okay, excellent. That's good to know. The next question from Gandalf. He says, one of the classic debates is between the guys that go for very realistic nymphs and those that are more interested in movement and go to suggestive patterns. Where does Rick think that the balance point is on this issue?
Well, I'm definitely in the movement and more suggestive or impressionistic schools with patterns. I really like my nymphs to have some movement to them, some wiggle to them when they're in the water. Anything that makes them look a little more lifelike to me is a good thing. And with the really realistic nymph, you don't get necessarily as much of that movement. That's not maybe always true, but in the majority of cases, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to have as much movement to them. So I go with more of the interested in movement and more suggestive patterns. Now, that said, I know we've got some other questions coming up where they're asking about size, shape, and color, and those kind of aspects of a pattern, what's most important. So I'll hold off on that until we get to those questions, but that's the other real important thing. But on this question, I would go, my preference is the more suggestive patterns than the realistic one.
Okay. Next question from Great Mountain Man. Or maybe it's Green Mountain Man. He'd like to know what you think about using indicators when nymphing. He learned without and still prefers it that way, which I do too, by the way, but anyway.
Yeah, that's a certainly point out that I use an indicator most of the time when I'm nymph fishing. One of the things I've done over the years, I have spent a fair bit of time in a wetsuit with a mask and snorkel, watching fish feed, watching insects underwater, and I've spent some time watching people fish nymphs and how the fish react. And I'm totally convinced that in watching fish take flies and spit them out, that you're getting probably twice as many strikes as you ever realize.
Right.
And if you're fishing an upstream nymph method where you're casting up or up and across and the nymphs are drifting back towards you, basically on a fairly slack line, I don't think there's any way or very, very difficult to detect a strike without an indicator. Now, once that those nymphs get past you and you're starting to have some tension on your leader and you're fishing more of that downstream end of the drift, then you've got some tension and you're going to be able to start feeling the strikes without an indicator. But I'm a real proponent of indicators because I think it improves the number of strikes that you see considerably. I fished for years without an indicator, and then once I started seeing what's going on underwater and started fishing an indicator, I realized how many more strikes I was actually getting when I used an indicator.
Right.
It does depend a bit on some of the methods, though, because there's methods like high sticking and check nymphing, if you get into those, that don't use indicators, and because of the way they're utilizing those methods, you have tension on the leader most of the drift,
uh-huh.
And so you're feeling strikes. But for a lot of nymphing, if you don't have a tight line, I think an indicator is really, really valuable.
Okay. That actually kind of takes us into our next question. Tyrone Fly asks, what are some of the techniques a newbie should know?
Well, I would say the first approach that a person starting nymphing should start looking at is fishing an indicator with split shot and a weighted nymph if you need it to get to the bottom, but put enough weight to get to the bottom. And mm-hmm. also fish a fairly short cast. Don't worry about making long casts. Fish water that's fairly close to you. Maybe only, you could do this with never casting more than 10 feet of fly line and cover a lot of water where there's plenty of fish. And if you do that when you're starting, especially when you're starting, you're going to have a lot less tangles, leader, casting. And it's not difficult to cast with a indicator, split shot, and a fly if you're just fishing 10 feet of fly line.
Right.
You almost just make a little roll cast upstream and it's already out there on the water. You don't have to false cast. That would be the basic setup I would tell someone to use.
Okay.
And once you got comfortable with that, then I would say put on a second fly and fish two nymphs if it's legal in the water you're fishing.
Right.
And that's a very effective way to kind of double your chances of having the right nymph on. Plus, again, you're going to get it to sink a little better, get it down to the bottom.
So,
still using an indicator. And I think once you get comfortable with that, I would certainly recommend you try some of the other tactics like high sticking and check nymphing. They get a little more sophisticated in how you manipulate the fly or have a feeling of the fly as it's drifting. But I think the standard way to start out would be with that indicator and basic weighted nymph to get it down on the bottom and short cast. The other thing that I think people that start nymphing, I always tell them, and this is related to an indicator, is that you should set the hook at least once every drift. And people will look at me and go, well, that's kind of strange because I'm not necessarily going to get a strike every drift. But the movement of the indicator is very, very subtle for most strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And on every drift, you're probably going to get the current doing something little subtle movement to your indicator that looks a little slightly unnatural. And you should actually lift up or give a little pull on your line to see if it's a fish or not every drift when you see that. And it's surprising that people are just starting how often when they start doing that every drift, they find out that they were setting the hook when there was a fish there when before they never, you know, thought there was anything there at all.
Yeah.
So that would be the other advice I'd have to someone just starting is set the hook at least once every drift when you think the indicator is just doing some minor little out of the normal movement.
Okay, that's valuable information there. Our next question's from Tyro. He said, excellent choice for an interview. I sat in on his class recently in Maupin and would recommend it for anyone. I would ask him this because it came up after the class. It's similar to Gandalf's question. When would you fish an imitative nymph and when would you switch to an attractor style?
Well, that's an interesting question because it gets to kind of the whole thing of matching hatches and how selective are fish really. And that's kind of a big topic all in of itself. And it's often the case that people, I think, tend to think that fish are not as selective to nymphs as they are to, say, dry flies. Certainly when you're fishing during a hatch and there's a large number of a certain insect on the water, that is when fish tend to get selective. But the same thing happens, I think, when fish are feeding below the surface and there's a particular type of nymph that's really dominant in the drift, drifting in the current. The fish are going to get selective to that particular type of nymph, whatever it is, its size, its color, its shape, the way it moves. And so my general approach to teaching fishing, fly fishing in general, is that you want to have some idea of what insects are out there. Right. And once you have an idea of what kind of nymphs are dominant, you're going to pick a pattern that's not necessarily an exact replica of it, but a pattern that's roughly looks like those that nymph that's the most dominant type in the stream the day you're fishing. And so I wouldn't say I'm using a real imitative nymph all the time, but I am using a pattern that's reflective of what is common in the drift of the day, you know, type of stream I'm fishing and when I'm fishing it.
Okay.
Now, attractive patterns can be really, really great. And that's where I think it's nice to use two flies, because you can put more of an attractive pattern on as one fly and then a more imitative nymph on as the other. And sometimes that is the best combination, because the attractor pattern might catch the fish's attention. And then they see, oh, that other more imitative nymph drifting behind it, and they actually take that.
Right.
But the attractor pattern might be the fly that actually caught the fish's attention. So I think that's a great combination when you're fishing two nymphs.
That's good to know. I was going to ask you, when you fish two nymphs, what do you use the same flies, or do you use different ones? But
I use different ones, and sometimes it's that attractor and more imitative version. But a lot of times it's just a larger fly and a smaller fly. The larger one weighted certainly to help get everything down, and then the smaller fly is a very, you know, kind of good general pattern of what's out there in the stream.
Excellent. That's going to be helpful for me. So our next question is from Duckster Man. He says, what does he think about using flash on wing cases versus not? Some folks would rather have a fuzziness on their wing cases, feeling it's more natural. Example, not coating a turkey feather wing case.
Yeah, well, I've already kind of mentioned that I like, you know, suggestive patterns with wiggle and some fibers that move. But I like flash on my nymphs. You know, I use bead heads routinely. I use flashback pheasant tails, flashback hare's ears. And I particularly like nymph patterns that have that kind of flashy material on them during a hatch. Because those nymphs that are swimming up to the surface, whether it's a mayfly or a caddis pupa, have little gas bubbles that they expel under their exoskeleton to help them get to the surface, but also to help them split that nymphal exoskeleton open when the adult's emerging in the surface film.
Uh-huh.
But on the way up, when they're coming up through the water column, they have that little shimmering, shiny look to them, those gas bubbles. And so some flash on your pattern really mimics that well, and there's been some great materials and approaches to imitate that that have come out, starting, you know, back with LaFontaine and his whole sparkle pupa thing with Antron.
Uh-huh.
We've got those poxy back nymphs now, and we've got some other really cool translucent type of V-rib material and other things like that to give it some translucence and some flash. So I really like those kinds of patterns when I'm imitating a nymph that's specifically emerging. And when I'm just fishing a nymph that's, you know, drifting on the bottom, a stonefly nymph that's not emerging,
mm-hmm.
I don't think it's necessarily as critical then, or maybe as big a factor, but it can still, I think, be useful. So, you know, that's kind of my take. I like the flash on there, especially when you're imitating nymphs that are actually emerging.
Excellent. That's good. It's good to know to differentiate between the two as well.
Yeah.
Next question's from Bugsy. He's actually got three questions in one. He says, what are the three things the typical fly angler fails to understand about aquatic entomology? Has the increased use of more accurate imitations resulted in larger populations of highly selective trout, or are my angling senses on a downward spiral?
I like that.
And then the size, shape, color, and presentation, what are the two most important areas to address when fishing the hatch?
Okay, well, let's take that question about has more accurate imitations resulted in smarter or more selective trout. You know, I'm not sure, and these things are pretty much impossible to prove, so it's, you know, one person's theory against another's.
Right.
But I'm not sure it's the use of more accurate patterns that maybe have gotten fish more selective as much as it is increased fishing pressure.
Okay.
I think when fish have been fished over frequently, and especially in waters where it's catch and release fishing, I have no doubt that those fish get smarter. And they get more sophisticated in recognizing what a leader, they don't know what a leader is, but they recognize seeing it, they can certainly see the leader, and they recognize that that's something they might stay away from.
Yeah.
Plus, they get more sophisticated in how they recognize presentations that aren't right. So if you've got any little bit of drag on your fly, or if your nymph's not drifting in a realistic way, the fish are much more sophisticated, I think, in recognizing that doesn't look quite right, and you're not taking it. So I think presentation becomes much more critical when you're fishing in those waters that are fished heavily, and the fish get smarter, as well as maybe they get more leader shy, so you got to go down and leader, or maybe use fluorocarbon leaders and that sort of thing.
Right.
And they certainly may get sensitized to certain patterns, and you go in with a different style pattern, and they might respond to it better. But I don't overall think it's necessarily use of more accurate imitations that result in smarter fish, as much as it is just the increased fishing pressure.
Okay.
Now, on the second question, size, shape, color, and presentation, what are the most important areas to address when fishing a hatch? I would say presentation is the most important. If you have the perfect fly, but if you present it poorly, you're not going to catch any fish, or very few fish.
Right.
And if you have just an okay fly, but you present it really well, you're probably going to do okay, pretty well fishing. So I think, first off, presentation is something you should think about. Make sure you're kind of taking care of that first. And that's kind of what's challenging, I think, for beginners in fly fishing, because there's a lot of different situations you run into with different types of currents, water types and things, where your presentation does get tricky. And when you haven't, you know, have the experience yet, you aren't sure if you're doing it right, you can run into problems. And that's always the case where you're fishing two guys, one guy's experienced, the other one isn't. He's catching a bunch of fish, and he says, well, here, take my rod and use mine, and I'll use yours, and you'll catch some fish because I've been doing well with this. Then you take the switch to rods, and immediately the guy that took the other fellow's rod, he's catching fish again, right? And the guy that took the other one is still not catching anything. Well, it's presentation.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. But of size, shape, and color, and again, this comes down where nymphing, I think this really gets forgotten often, is size, I believe, is the most important aspect of your nymph patterns.
Okay.
And if you spent any little time collecting some natural nymphs from a stream and putting your imitations, your patterns, in a tray next to the naturals, you'll quickly see that most of your nymph patterns are much bigger, probably twice the size of the naturals you intend to imitate.
Uh-huh.
And it's just natural for people, when they think about putting a nymph on, throwing it underwater where they don't see it, it's a big river maybe, and they get a tie on a little 16 nymph pattern, they think, well, there's no way a trout's going to see that.
Yeah.
But the reality is, those small nymph patterns tend to work better than the bigger nymphs, especially in waters that are fished heavily, like we were talking about in that other question.
Yeah.
Or in the first part of this question. So I would definitely pay attention to size and try to get your nymphs to match the size of the particular nymph you think you're imitating, whether it's a stonefly or caddis or mayfly. And then next would be shape. If it's a skinny nymph, you want your pattern skinny.
Okay.
If it's a fat nymph, you want your pattern fat. But again, a lot of commercial nymphs are all tied fairly fat, or if you're tying, it's easy to over-dress a nymph pattern and make it fatter. So I tend to try to really impress on people to keep your nymph pattern slender, don't overdress them, and don't be afraid to fish small nymph patterns, 16s, 18s, even 20s.
Wow.
And then last is color. To me, is the least important of your factors. I want a pattern that's close in color, but if you picked up 10 different green rock worms in a stream off the same rock, you're going to see that there's slightly different shades of color of those 10 green rock worms. Same thing with pale mooring dun mayflies or blue-winged olive mayflies. You pick up 10 or 15 of them, you're going to see that they're not all the same color.
Right.
So I don't tend to agonize over color. I just want it close.
All right. So our next question comes from Silver. He says, is there a relationship between the size of an adult to the size of the emerger and nymph/pupa one fishes for the same hatch? For example, for a size 14 adult mayfly or caddis, should one fish the same size nymph or pupa to imitate the immature aquatic form of that same hatch? Or is the immature insect smaller or larger?
Great question. Well, let's take, there's a bit of a difference between the type of insects you might be talking about here. Look, with mayflies, if you're looking looking at a mature nymph that's hatching, so whatever it is, a March Brown, Pale Morning Dun, if you're looking at a mature nymph, that dun that hatches on the surface is going to be roughly the same size as the nymph. So if it's a 14 nymph, the dun is going to be matched with a 14. If you collect some duns off the surface of the water, and they're a 14, and you're wondering what nymph would be the right size, you're in good shape to put on a size 14 nymph.
Okay.
With caddis, however, that isn't true. So you might be seeing some caddis larvae that could be fairly large, say a green rockworm again. The larva might be a size 10 or 12. The pupa of that is probably going to be a full size smaller. And then the adult caddis will be roughly the same size as the pupa. So it's size 14 pupa. The adult caddis that pops out of that is going to be a 14. But the nymph will be a good size, maybe even two sizes larger than that pupa was.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Now, with stoneflies, they're going to be roughly the same size again. So
yeah.
If you collect a mature stonefly and it's, you know, getting ready to crawl out onto the bank to hatch into the adult, or you've seen some adult stoneflies flying around and you've collected it and it's a size 10 or 8, whatever, the nymph, the mature nymph, is going to be roughly that same size.
Yeah, I got to say, I had never seen a stonefly hatch before. I went down to Rock Creek near Missoula, Montana, here with another member came up from Florida, Gill's Gone Wild, and we went down there, and the stoneflies were hatching. Holy moly, are those things huge.
Yeah,
I've never seen
them. During a salmon fly hatch or a golden stonefly hatch, they are really big, like size 4s.
Holy cow, the things, they were massive.
It's very impressive. The other thing I should say about the stoneflies, though, is that these big stoneflies, the nymphs take 3 to 4 years to get fully grown.
Uh-huh.
And so most of the year, even though when you saw those big adults out and it say they were size 6, 3X long or 4X long, once that hatch is over, you still have lots of the same stonefly, salmon fly nymphs, out in the stream, but they're much smaller than those
uh-huh.
adults were, because they're not the mature size yet. They're only maybe 1 year old or 2 years old instead of the fully grown 3 or 4 year old age nymphs. And so after that hatch, you should drop your sizes down in stonefly nymphs considerably. Instead of using a size 6 or an 8, I always fish 10s and 12s through most of the year. And
wow.
It's only in that early season when those big nymphs are ready to hatch that I use those big nymph patterns for stoneflies.
Next question, we've only got a few more left, is from Cyberfish. And he says, the saying goes, bright day, bright fly, dark day, dark fly. Do you experience this when nymphing? He said, my experience is bright day, dinky trout.
Yeah, that could be true, bright day, dinky trout. Well, when it comes to nymphing and color fly, basically, no. I can't say that I follow that rule formula, bright day, bright fly, dark day, dark fly. I think that bright days has a lot to do with fish behavior. And if it's in mostly the summer, you know, warmer seasons of the year, fish tend to avoid open water,
uh-huh.
I think, on bright days. They have learned that on a bright, nice, sunny day, they're more vulnerable to predators from ospreys, herons, whatever it might be. And I think, and in general, trout don't particularly like bright light in their eyes. So they're going to be in areas where there's good shade from trees. So this is what I look for on a bright day. I look for places where there's shade on the water.
Uh-huh.
The fish, or where there's turbulence. If you're in a riffle and you've got turbulent water that's creating turbulence on the surface, that provides cover and shade and protection for the fish also. And so I tend to focus maybe on different water types on bright days, because I think fish are in different places on bright days. When it's a nice overcast day, the fish will be out more in open areas and eating more in open areas than they might be on a bright day. Now, it does change, I think, with time of year as well. And it's all going to be, there's always exceptions, and it's going to vary a bit with insect activity. So if you get a big, strong insect hatch on a bright day, you might see plenty of fish out in a flat feeding
uh-huh.
where they're exposed. But if there's no insect hatches that are going to, you know, really get them out there, they're going to be more in places where there's cover.
Okay.
In the winter, you get more of your insect hatches on those warmer, brighter days in the winter, and that gets more fish feeding out in those areas on a bright day in the winter than you'd see them on the summer, probably.
Okay.
So that's what I try to keep in mind on bright days, is look for places in the shade and where there's cover.
Well, we got 3 questions left. Have you got time to carry on?
Let's get to them. They're good questions.
All right. Well, we got one from Rainbow Chaser. He says, I'm wondering how he discusses stream entomology at the most basic level without getting lost in a ton of qualifiers. When I try to tell someone why I tied a particular fly a particular way, it seems that I have to stop and throw in something like sometimes, usually, in this case, etc. Several times in a simple sentence, he says, I shudder to think how bad it would get if I was if I wasn't really fairly ignorant.
I had to laugh when I read that. That's a great question. And there's a tremendous amount of information out there. I teach an aquatic entomology class at the university here in Portland for graduate students. It's a 10-week class. And even in a 10-week class, you're just really starting to get into it. You know, you're kind of scratching the surface. So it's really hard to give people in-depth information without making it confusing. So what you really have to do is identify what the key points are that you're going to make about whatever aspect of entomology you're talking about. So like, say you're talking about mayflies, where there's hundreds of species and lots of sizes and shapes and lots of hatches, and you could go on for, you know, hours and hours and hours about describing different mayflies. But to keep it simple, you can just kind of identify that there's swimmers, clingers, crawlers, and burrowers. And if you learn those four types and how to recognize those four types, that's going to really help you understand how you might change nymph patterns and how you might change your fishing tactics. So you just identify some very simple key points and try to make sure you stress those. And you need to point out that there's always exceptions. And the one thing I really try to stress to folks in my classes is that you need to become the observer and really pay attention to what's going on out there on the stream. So I try to make sure they understand what to look for. And then if they're good at observing, they're going to understand themselves, well, geez, all of a sudden the mayfly hatch is over, but fish are feeding on a caddis. Mm-hmm. Or, gosh, it's a spinner on the water, mayfly spinner, and duns that the fish are feeding. And that's really a matter of good observation and understanding enough about what you're seeing to understand how you might change your pattern selection and so forth based on that. But if anglers learn to just sit down and quit fishing for 15, 20, 30 minutes and observe what's going on, in many cases, that's going to do more to improve your fishing than just about anything else you do. So you don't have to know lot names. You don't have to know, you know, all the technical jargon to be good at understanding what's going on the stream, but you do have to be a good observer.
Right. I think we can all practice that a little bit more.
And it's fun. I mean, that's the cool thing. I mean, I get just a heck of a kick out of this. Sitting and watching fish feed for 10 or 15 minutes will teach you a whole lot about how your flies should be presented.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, take a pair of small binoculars with you.
Yeah.
Because it is amazing what you'll see on the water 30 feet in front of you with a pair of binoculars that you can't see with your eyes.
Yeah.
And so whenever you get in a situation you aren't sure what's going on, if you've got a little pair of travel binoculars with you, boy, it can solve a lot of questions.
Next question from Shaky Wader. I would really like to hear his thoughts on the use of a throat pump. Should it be used at all? What's the correct method?
Okay. Well, I don't recommend the use of throat pumps. And the reason is that I think it's challenging enough for people to handle fish carefully and release them and let them go, you know, healthy fish go. And if you add in the extra time handling a fish with a throat pump, if you're using the throat pump correctly, you've got to handle the fish a lot more. So I don't recommend it. Throat pumps are effective at getting, you know, at what the fish are certainly been feeding on. And they can solve, you know, some puzzles that way. But because of that extra use, I don't recommend it. I would rather see, actually, if you're on a stream where you can keep a fish, actually go ahead and keep one fish to eat, clean it, check its stomach, and go that route. But obviously, a lot of the waters where fishing are catch and release, which I think is great. But the stomach pumps can be a problem.
Yeah.
If you're using one, the thing you want to definitely avoid is you don't actually force the stomach pump into the throat of the trout or down the throat. You're going to put just a little bit of water in the bulb, and then you're going to squeeze the bulb. You're going to put the pump into just where you're meeting some resistance in the back of the mouth with the throat pump. Then you squeeze the water in the pump gently out of the bulb, and then right after you've squeezed it out, you let go of the bulb so you're sucking the water back up into it, and that's when you kind of draw out anything that's in that fore part of the throat of the trout into the bulb, and then you can squeeze it into a little tray or lid or something to see what's you actually got out of the fish.
Okay.
So, you know, you want to be gentle. You don't need to force anything, but I get nervous about the amount of time it takes to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't take much to harm the fish.
Now, those fish are stressed already, you know, if you've
right.
wiped them.
Right.
And I would just, in fact, there's some regulations now in some states where you can't lift the trout out of the water to release them. If it's catch and release, you have to unhook them underwater, or just while the fish is still in the water, the head can be out of the water.
Yep.
But you can't actually lift the fish out of the water.
Yeah, there's some saltwater species like that as well.
Yeah.
You can't.
And that, you know, makes sense. You know, they're seeing some problems with some of these catch and release waters where a lot of fish get played and handled pretty roughly, and
mm-hmm.
it takes its toll.
Yeah. So Jeffro wants to know, does water temperature matter when nymphing? And then what time of the year is best to nymph?
Water temperature matters. The answer I kind of have in my head here is yes and no. Thing with water temperature, it's going to affect the fish more than the insects. Say when in the wintertime,
mm-hmm.
when the water is cold, the actual insects out there in the stream are quite active. And there's probably as much or more insect nymph activity, maybe not hatches, but nymph activity in the winter, just as much as there is other times of the year.
Really?
But there's plenty of nymphs drifting and moving around and there for fish to eat.
Okay.
But the fish are a lot less active, and they're not going to move as far to feed. They're not feeding as much in the winter in cold water or whenever it's cold. And so you need to have better presentation in cold water. You need to get your flies closer to the trout.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to move as far. And you just need to recognize that fishing is probably going to be a little slower. You're not going to catch as many fish because the fish themselves are feeding less. And so there's going to be fewer fish that are, you know, out there really aggressively feeding or feeding a lot. You're just likely to catch fewer fish. Now, if there's some streams that are in spring creeks that are just cold all year long, you know, it's 40 degrees year-round, those fish have really acclimated to that temperature, and they probably have a, you know, pretty normal level of feeding activity because they've acclimated to it.
Right.
But if you're in a stream that has, you know, a lot of variable temperature ranges in it from season to season, when it gets cold in the winter, they're just going to move less, and you're going to have to get your flies closer to them and fish a little slower water when it's cold and just not expect maybe to catch quite as many.
Right.
So now what time of year is it best to nymph? I'd say any time of year, nymphing is going to be what fish, nymphs are what fish feed on most of the time,
right.
any time of year. I would say time of day, though, is something to keep in mind. There's a, I'll be real quick here, there's a thing called behavioral drift. This is a phenomenon that occurs in streams every day of the year. And what it is that you can imagine that these nymphs are down on the bottom and occasionally they let go of the rocks or get washed off and they're drifting in the current.
Right.
Well, there's periods of the day when this drift activity really peaks, and it consistently peaks right in the morning, about an hour before to an hour after sunset, and right into evening, about in the morning before sunrise,
mm-hmm.
and in the evening, an hour before to an hour after sunset.
Okay.
And these periods of sunrise and sunset is peak activity of nymphs drifting in the current. Those are your consistently best times to nymph fish. The other time when it's really good nymphing is when there's a hatch going on, prior to the hatch. Mayfly hatch, caddis hatch, midge hatches. You've got a lot of things, the nymphs or pupa drifting and swimming up to the surface, and that's another peak activity of drift. And that could be middle of the day or, you know, whenever that hatch occurs.
Uh-huh.
But, boy, don't miss a chance to go nymph fishing early in the morning or later in the evening. If there's nothing else going on, that's a great time of day to nymph fish, and that's true year day in and day out, no matter what time of year.
Well, that's good news and that's bad news. I can no longer have an excuse to sleep in when I'm on vacation.
Oh, yeah,
fishing,
you know, I tend to sleep in, though. I tend to concentrate more on the evening activity than the morning.
Yeah, I try to enjoy myself when I'm out fishing.
Yeah.
All right.
Great to be out on the water in the morning. It's a beautiful time out there.
Ah, yes, it is. It really is.
Yeah.
Last question from Ducksterman. How would you sample the ecosystem of a still water?
That's a very good question. And what I do, and I do it routinely, is there's a net. You can't use a kick screen. You know, it's just
Right.
That doesn't work in a lake or a pond in still water. But there's other types of nets, and one that works very well is called a D-frame kick net, and it's kind of like a butterfly net, only the hoop is in the shape of the letter D, so it's a flat bottom that you can rest on the lake or stream bottom.
Okay.
And the wire is much heavier than a butterfly net, so it, you know, can hold up in current if you're using it in a stream.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, and then it's got a net bag, like a cheesecloth net bag, that goes back a couple of feet. Again, kind of like a butterfly net. And with that, in a lake, you can sweep that net through vegetation along the lake bottom or along a sandy or softer bottom area of the lake. And whatever bugs are out there in that habitat, you'll get in the net bag. And you just keep sweeping it, moving it, so that you create your own current, in a sense, and things get stuck in the net bag and you can lift it out of the water. And this has a long handle, usually like a 5-foot handle, so you can dip it down in water that might be, you know, 4, 5, 6 feet deep even, and get a little sample like that. So that's what I do, is wade out along the shoreline areas in water that might be 1, 2 feet deep out to about 4 or 5 feet deep, and get the, using a net like that, you can get a good sample of the bugs. The other thing you can do is pick up some wood debris. If there's branches or small chunks of wood that's on the bottom of the lake, that's a great habitat for insects.
Okay.
You can pick that stuff up. You can pick up, again, rocks and some aquatic plants. But whenever you're collecting, whether you're doing it in lakes or streams, you want to really think about the habitat and are you really causing any harm to the habitat. If you're in an area where there's some sensitive plants or aquatic plants sometimes don't regrow really fast, you don't want to go out there and just rip up a lot of aquatic plants just to look at a few bugs. So, you know, think about, if you take a net and just kind of sweep it along gently, you're not going to hurt anything. So kind of keep in mind, you know, are you doing something that might cause a problem there? But most of the time, you'll be fine.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. That's a lot of information. So,
great questions. You know, I appreciate the opportunity to come online and talk about them.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. We really appreciate you taking the time on this nice 4th of July weekend to sit and answer some of our questions. If somebody was interested, Rick, in purchasing one of your DVDs or a book or anything that you offer, how would they go about contacting you?
Well, I have a website, www.laughingrivers, one word, and make sure you have the S on the river, so it's laughingrivers.com.
Okay.
And there's information there on the books and videos, and you can buy them right offline, online, and go from there. So, and I'm actually working on a new DVD, an instructional DVD right now on emergers and dries, fishing emergers and dries.
Oh, good.
That's not going to be out for a while, probably another 6 to 9 months before it's out there, but we're doing the shooting right now, so.
Excellent.
There'll be something else coming out.
Will be something to look forward to.
Yep, there's also a list of places I'm giving talks. If people want to contact me for programs, you can get in touch with me through the website. You can actually see what kind of programs I have to offer on the website as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for taking time out of your 4th of July weekend to chat with me here. Really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, though. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to the folks online with you, and it's been a lot of fun. So I hope some of this information will help folks through the summer fishing season. We're coming up to a great time of year to be out on the water. So
yeah, I hope I can get out and do some of it myself.
Exactly. I think it's time.
Yeah, we'll see. As soon as this thing heals up, I'm going to be out on the water like a duck, man. It's going to be great. So.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
All right. Take care.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is all we have time for this week. Thank you so much for joining me for another FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. Thanks again to Rick Haefeli. What a great guy, for taking time out of his 4th of July weekend to chat with me for almost an hour. Now, the next podcast I'm going to do is going to feature Brian Chan. He is an expert on fly fishing for trout in still waters, and that is a venue that I think more and more of us are trying and being exposed to. So don't forget your notebook and your pencil or your pen for that one. And please, again, keep the suggestions coming on people you'd like to hear interviewed. Both Rick Haefeli and Brian Chan are people who members requested I interview, and I'm doing my best to do that. I also try to get Lefty Cray, unfortunately,
In his own words, he's flunked retirement and he has been extremely busy. I will keep banging on his door, though. That's somebody I would absolutely love to have on here. And then maybe A.K. Best or John Gearhart, a few very well-known authors and other people in the fly fishing industry. So keep the suggestions coming. Keep listening. Look forward to hearing everybody's thoughts on this. If you think there's something I can do better or change, let me know. I'm always open to suggestions. This is for you, not necessarily for my own pleasure. Thanks again. Till next time, tight lines.